We're going to continue on with Laplace's equation. That's my plan. And then I thought we'd, after a few minutes on Laplace's equation, we'd be done, and then we'd move on to analysis and the Fourier transform so we can actually believe in some of the things we've been doing. But those few minutes, I think, are going to have grown into 2 hours. So I think I'm going to talk mostly about Laplace's equation still today. I hope that's okay. And I'm really running from the GO bus, and I'm going to drink water so I can catch my breath and all. So let's start. That's my post-it on my notes. We had just talked about the fundamental solution. I'm going to spend 1 minute, maybe three, reminding you of what that is. We found a function gamma. And gamma is a function of R. And I'm going to abuse my notation by saying gamma is a function of x minus y. And it was a constant times x minus y to a power, n minus 2. And you see the abuse of notation is it really should be a function of r is the distance from x to y, but there's so many chalk lines in the board, I'm going to leave them off, and it's abuse of notation, that's what I meant. And the constant turns out to be 1 over, if I remember it right, 2 minus n, so it's actually negative, and this is for n greater than or equal to 3, so it's negative constant. The surface area of the unit sphere, unit normalizing, in n dimension, times 1 upon, well, that's the constant, x minus y to the n minus 2. Now, what happens when n is equal to 2? It's different. Just because when you integrate inverse powers, one power is different. So it turns out to be a constant, which is 1 upon 2 pi, which is the surface area of the unit sphere in two dimensions, which is just the circumference of a circle, times the log of x minus y. So now I have a question for you this morning. When n is equal to 1, what is it? That's what gamma is. When n equals 1, what's gamma? I'll remind you of its property. That remember we did the following thing. So a reminder, which is we proved essentially this, that when I integrate gamma of x minus y against u of y dy, I found that to be equal to, against Laplacian u of y, and I want to integrate over all of Rn, and I did this calculation actually in a domain I found, omega, and I found boundary terms, but over all of Rn, I'm going to find no boundary terms because I'm going to have gamma go to zero with this derivative there. I found that this was equal to u at x. Remember that calculation? We went out to radius rho and then took a limit, and the boundary terms and that little sphere were twofold, one which vanished in the limit, one which gave us that in the limit. It was theorem 222. So this was theorem 222, I think. At least in my notes, that's the numbering. And I want to read this as saying Laplacian of gamma equals the delta function. This is distributional reading of this line. And I'm going to talk about distributions in a couple of times. But in any case, this gets us ready for distributions. When you read this in terms of distributions, as a distribution, it says, so now we'll go back to n equal 1. How do I take something whose second derivative is a delta function? Yes? Yeah. I'm actually not sure you're allowed to answer because you're a postdoc and a ringer. But yes, since nobody else is answering, yes. So what's the integral of the Heaviside function? The Heaviside function, I have to take So let's work that through. I have to take two derivatives and get a delta function. So in fact, no, you're allowed to answer at this point. So I have to take one derivative. I have to take one derivative and get a jump of one, because when I take a jump of one, a derivative of a jump of one, I get the delta function. People have to think distributionally. If you don't know what this means, wait a couple of days. So what's the primitive of the jump function? Absolute value. Absolute value. So gamma is equal to the absolute value of x minus y. And it's not quite that, because the jump in the derivative there is from minus 1 to plus 1, it's 2. So I have to divide by the surface area of the unit sphere. But the unit sphere in one dimension has 2 points. And what's the surface area of 2 points? It's a zero dimensional surface area. It's 2. So even the formula works. Modulo getting this power right. Okay, that was fun. This is the fundamental solution. And we remember a little bit what we were doing. So I want to go on to say that we had the formula. We had a formula that dictated that for harmonic functions, Laplacian u equals 0. Then the formula was that 0 is equal to the integral over domain of gamma Laplacian u, gamma of x minus y, Laplacian u of y dy. It's 0 because Laplacian u is 0, and then we integrated away parts to say that this was equal to, let's see how I did it. Actually, my formula and my notes and probably what I wrote on the blackboard is just what I called x and what I called y. So we had x in the integral, and this turned out to be u of y. And I want to take y a point inside omega, that is, here I think of a domain omega, and here's some point y inside of it. And here's the boundary of it. U of I plus some boundary integral. And that boundary integral had two things which are actually hidden by my post-it. One was gamma of x minus y, the normal derivative of u, minus the normal derivative of gamma, x minus y, u, ds. And these are all actually in x variables, right? So I'm integrating x variables. This is the normal derivative of x variables. This is normal, and this is x, right? All x's, right? And then I wanted to define a fundamental solution as exactly this kind of distribution, that Laplacian of gamma is equal to the delta function, so that this formula always holds. And so I want to have a question now, which I want to also point out, so it's maybe a remark. Oh, here's the question, which I'll say the answer immediately. Is the fundamental solution in that property, is it unique?
No.
Because why? That's right. You can add any other harmonic function and have the same property. So gamma plus w of x. Let's see. I want to decide what my variables are. Right. Gamma of x. I use the fact that gamma is harmonic in x. So gamma of x minus y plus w of x also is fundamental solution for all when Laplacian W equals 0, right? Because then, of course, you take Laplacian X of gamma plus W, and it's equal to Laplacian X gamma plus Laplacian X W, and the Laplacian X W gives me 0, and Laplacian X gamma gives me the delta function at Y. So let's just point out this. You can do whatever you want with that. And in particular, I could add a constant. In particular, so there are two things I'm going to do. I'm going to add w is equal to a constant in just a second. And then I'm also going to add a more sophisticated w I'm not going to complete that discussion until we return to elliptic equations, but I'm going to add something which gives us the Green's function when I'm in my discussion of the Green's function. Okay? So let me do the following thing. So in particular, we could let thing is falling apart. I just had a piece fall on me. I'm a little worried about this. This is a piece of blackboard that's just fell out. In particular, we could do the following thing. I want to take a new fundamental solution, gamma of x minus y, but then I'm going to subtract a constant. Which constant? How about if I subtract gamma of rho, and I want to put it on a particular domain, on the ball radius rho about y? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to think of this as being, so here's y, and then I'm going to take ball's radius rho about y, so this is, gives me this radius, and I want to take rho so it's small enough so that fits in my domain. That's my plan, to study this. Okay? And then I'm going to use this formula that I wrote down here handily. And it says that u of y, I'm going to rewrite it, so u of y equals to some stuff. Oh, I forgot to say I want u harmonic. So let's take u harmonic, and then u of y is going to equal some stuff. Okay? So, like, take u harmonic. Everyone's used to me saying Laplacian u equals zero means u is a harmonic function, right? And then I'm going to use the formula. So u of y is equal to the integral over the boundary. Oh, let's see what it says. U of y is equal to the integral of that new gamma of Laplacian of u. Laplacian u is zero, so this is zero, minus this integral. And I use that new thing on that integral. So it's going to be equal to, what can I say? It's going to be equal to the boundary, integral over the boundary of this minus that. So that's, it's going to be equal to, let's see, u partial r gamma of r, that's this term, minus that term. The minus sign because it goes to the other side of the equation. Minus I'm being a little bit short here, so let me do the following thing. Partial, this is integral over the surface rho about the sphere rho about y. So I have to d by dr is the exterior unit derivative, and then I have gamma of x minus y minus gamma of rho. Okay, against u of x dfx. Then I have to minus the other term, s rho y, and then I have the partial r of u, it's the partial normal of u, times gamma of x minus y minus gamma of rho on the sphere of radius rho. Okay? Laplacian with respect to x of gamma plus w equals Laplacian with respect to x of gamma plus Laplacian with respect to x of w, which is equal to Laplacian with respect to x of gamma gives me a delta function. Laplacian with respect to x of w gives me zero because w is harmonic. So I can add any harmonic function to a fundamental solution, and it's also a fundamental solution. That's why I say a rather than the fundamental solution. Because I'm adding these two, so I'm adding these two because it's a linear operator, so I'm adding these two. This plus zero. I didn't have to write the zero, but I just did it for rhetorical purposes. If I were Russian, I guess I wouldn't have had to make the distinction because A and the, you know, forget all the articles. My Russian friends tell me, or maybe they don't tell me. What's the charm of me having taken this constant away? Remember, rho is a constant. It's because this is zero. So I get to ray out this term. And I've now proved something. Oh, and let me take the r derivative of here. So I've just proved the following thing. I'll rewrite it. U of y is equal to the integral of the over the sphere of radius rho about y of u of x times this quantity. So partial r gamma of r evaluated at r equals rho d surface area in x. Okay? And if I work that out, the r derivative of gamma, well, these are just functions of r. We just work out what they are. And so it's equal to, if you work that out, the integral of the surface of the sphere radius rho about y of u of x times, well, this is just a constant because, again, it's a function that depends only on r, and you're evaluating at r equals rho. And that constant is 1 over omega n rho to the n minus 1. Let me make it clearer. Rho to the n minus 1 dsx. So this allows us to state our first theorem of the day. So theorem 2, and I think we're on 23, if my notes are hold right. I don't think I slipped anything by us. And it says the following thing. This is known to Gauss. This is derived by Gauss. So it's Gauss's law of arithmetic mean. Which states the following thing. A harmonic function, so it basically says the following. A harmonic function u of x satisfies the following thing. U at y is equal to 1 upon omega n rho to the n minus 1, the integral on a sphere of radius rho about y of u of x d surface area x. Which is an interesting thing. It says if I have a harmonic function here, Laplacian u equals 0 here, then the value of u in the center of any ball which lies in the domain is the same as the value of u integrated around the boundary. Okay? Although it's related to the Cauchy formula of complex variables, I would say. But anyway, depends on whether you're French or German, I guess. And if I just change variables in this, I can say this is 1 over omega n, integral over let me say, x prime in the unit sphere about 0. I'll take u, and I'll start at y, and then I'll add rho times x prime. And then I'll have d unit surface area. Sometimes you want to use it this way. Okay? And then sometimes you want to use it this way, which is I can integrate this. Thank you. That's what I wanted to do. So once I have this, I can also integrate up. So I'm going to integrate the left-hand side, but the trouble is I didn't put that in my notes. So now you have to rely on you for me to check as I integrate in rho to make sure I get it right. If I integrate the left-hand side, I'm going to integrate the left-hand side let's see what I want to do. I want to integrate the left-hand side of this from 0 to rho d rho prime. So it's going to be the integral from 0 to rho u of y d rho prime. And now I want this to be also on the right-hand side, but actually I want to have the volume area. So I need a u of rho, u of y, it's a constant. Rho prime to the n minus 1 d rho prime is equal to 1 upon omega n. I run multiply by rho prime to the n minus 1, rho prime to the n minus 1, so it's going to be integral 0 to rho, integral of s dot y of rho, u of x d s x. And now I have this d rho, something's d rho prime, something's wrong. Well, this is that coefficient. That's that coefficient. But I need the right weight in. Here I want to have a. I'm integrating x in a. I need a. No, that's right. That's right. Because this is the sphere with surface area proportional to rho to the n minus 1. So I claim that this is equal to 1. This is equal to 1 over omega n still missing something. Darn. Quick, who has it in their mind? What I'm getting is 1 over omega n rho, integral over the ball radius rho around y of u of x dx. Because this contains the rho to the n minus 1 d rho. And the only thing I'm not getting is the volume of the ball of radius rho out. So something is not quite right. Yeah, see, something's a little bit wrong in this. I better take this without struggling. I know the solution to this. It shows the power of, don't write this down because it's wrong, but what I need for you is to get it right. And it's a rho integral in this formula. So problem set. I think it's number 5 already. And I wasn't going to give this problem, but I find myself stuck and it's hard to think on one's feet. So work out the volume. Work out the rho integral of this. So u of y is equal to, this is, work out the Gauss's law when on the right-hand side I have a volume integral. So Gauss's law with the right-hand side a volume integral. That means it's going to read that u of y is equal to 1 over, actually it's the volume of the unit ball. So it's going to be, as people say, n over omega sub n, rho to the n, integral over the unit of the ball of radius rho about y of u of x dx. And if I get those constants wrong, you can tell me, but I think those constants are right. Okay, you have to prove that, and the way you prove it, I'm even telling you how to prove it, is you iterate this d rho with the proper weight. Okay, I'm sorry I took so long on that. Okay, well, let's see. Pause. Where are we? This has its proof here, because I used my formula for a fundamental solution with a particular case. I took away a constant from my old fundamental solution, a constant surely harmonic. So I want you to note the following thing. When you are studying Laplace's equation on a computer, you usually replace finite partial derivatives with partial differences. And so you say the partial difference h of u is equal to, well, let's do it in two dimensions. So here's the point x in my lattice, and here's x plus, let me see, how do I do this in a lattice? Xy in a lattice. And so it's going to be u of x plus 1, maybe it's x plus h, plus u of x plus h y, plus u of x minus h y plus u of x y plus h plus u of x y minus h minus 4 times u of x y. That's the classic finite difference. Actually, you divide by h squared. And so it says, here's the point x, y in the lattice, and you add this value, and this value, and this value, and this value, and you subtract 4 times that value. And you say that if this is equal to 0, then you say that's a finite difference harmonic function, right? It's a harmonic differences function. And so I want to say even that operator is the same as Gauss's law, because what you're doing is you're taking a sphere over a neighborhood, which constitutes those 4 points, and the average of that, the weighted average of that, divided by 4, is equal to u. So any finite difference harmonic function, just by reading the operator, the finite difference operator, it's Gauss's law. So Gauss's law are the same as the most naive differencing available in that situation. Suppose you wanted to do a more complex footprint for Laplace's equation to get a higher order scheme. You would do one which is consistent with Gauss's law. That's one of the things you would do. You might want to include the second nearest neighbors, or in some weighted way, the third and fourth nearest neighbors. I mean, it's up to you to decide on your level of numerical accuracy and sophistication. But you would do it in a way which is consistent with Gauss's law, which I've just given you. Where? X prime is the difference between this and this is this. I take a sphere of radius rho around y, and that's x is in that sphere. But here, I change variables, so x prime is in a sphere of radius 1 around 0, and I suggest a change of variables of this formula. And I explicitly move y plus rho times that unit direction. It's just ds x prime is the unit surface area. Ds x prime is the surface area over a sphere which has radius rho. Okay, it's differences by a scaling. Okay, brings us to the point. Let's make a definition, which is a function u of x, and I'm going to call this a continuous function u of x in our domain is called, well, I call harmonic functions if they're twice differentiable and they satisfy Gauss's law. No, if they're twice differentiable and Laplacian equals zero, of them equals zero. So I'm going to call u a function which is subharmonic. Call a function subharmonic if u of y is not necessarily equal to, but is less than the result given by that formula. So it's less than or equal to 1 upon omega n rho n minus 1 integral over sphere radius rho about r u of x ds x. And you can also put the volume version of this right-hand side, if you wish, but I'll leave that up to you as adding that into your problem set problem. Okay? And a superharmonic so this says it satisfies not Gauss's law of arithmetic mean, but an inequality associated with Gauss's law. And a superharmonic if it satisfies the other inequality, u of y greater than or equal to this stuff. Okay? And then I want to say, what significance does this have? So let's talk about that for a little bit. So significance. Let's see, one thing is, let's make another function and I need a name for another function, w. If w of x is harmonic and on the sphere of rho about y, w of x equals u of x. So I want to say this. Significance, let's start with a subharmonic function. Let u of x be subharmonic. That's what I wanted to say. If w is harmonic and it has the same boundary values as u, then what happens? Then u of x minus w of x is also subharmonic. Okay? Let's see. It's because when I integrate u of x around a ball, I'll get above u of y, but when I integrate w of x around that sphere, I will get equal to, then I will equal wy. So I'll have u of y minus w of y is still less than or equal to the right-hand side, which is the integral over a sphere. Right, so this is subharmonic. And let's see, I want to also conclude something. U of x minus w of x is subharmonic. And furthermore, u of x equals w of x on the sphere radius rho around y. And that means the following. Sorry, I'm thinking it in my mind without writing it down. That says u of y minus w of y is less than or equal to these constants, which are going to be irrelevant in a second, n minus 1, integral over the sphere about y radius rho, of u of x minus w of x, but that's 0, of 0, dsx. So that u, so that this is always negative, which means w always dominates u. So that says u of x lies below w of x for all x in, so u of x lies below w of x at the center, u of y at the center lies below w of y. That's what I want to say. The center of the ball. No, I only say the center. I only said the center. But in fact, this can be jacked up, and it will in a second when I do the maximum principle, to show that a subharmonic function, I'm trying to explain why sub. It's the harmonic function, it's a function which lies below any other harmonic function which shares its boundary values on any disk around it. Okay, so this can be made stronger, but I just wanted to explain sub, and that was what that argument was. So that's argument for significance. So secondly, second part of the significance is let u actually be C2. So I was just talking about a continuous function. I was just iterating it on a sphere. But let u actually be C2. Then we can say the following thing, that Laplacian u of x is greater than or equal to 0. That's a subharmonic. And similarly, Laplacian u of x less than or equal to 0 is superharmonic. And it's for the same reasons. It's for the same reasons that it's just confusing which way the sign goes. You see, because you think of super as being bigger, but Laplacian is the sub case, and Laplacian being less than is the super case. And it's the same thing. A subharmonic function will lie below any function which satisfies its boundary, the same boundary values, and a super will lie above. And so what I want you to do is, this is problem set, now it's problem two. And this is problem two of that problem set. And that is, I want you to prove this statement. So prove this statement. Prove this statement. Well, what do I mean by that? My definition has sub and superharmonic in terms of these arithmetic means on spheres. So prove for me that if you have a C2 function which satisfies Laplacian greater than or equal to 0, then this function on any ball satisfies that inequality. And similarly, well, just take minus u. If u is subharmonic, minus u is superharmonic. You only have to do one, and then remark for two. Okay? So that's sub and super. It will be at every point of the domain with every ball, any ball of radius, any row of around it, as long as rho is small enough so that ball, that sphere fits into the domain also. No. Oh, it could be. It could be. It could be. What would cause Laplacian u to be greater than zero? If it actually was the potential, the electrostatic potential for a charge which was positive everywhere. And similarly, for negative. That's one way to make it positive. There are other reasons why you might look at sub and superharmonic functions, too, but that's one reason. So I want to move on from this. It's very appropriate to move on to the maximum principle. We've already had that once. We did it with an explicit integral kernel that we got from a Fourier integral, but I want to do it now as a more general object. So, the maximum principle. And that's theorem 223, so I'm going to put here is theorem 24. Which is, I want to say it in two ways. I'm going to say that this is the weak maximum, often called the weak maximum principle, and then I'm going to say the strong maximum principle, and then we'll have them, and I'm going to prove them one at a time. So let's see. I want to let omega be a bounded domain and connected. In n dimensions. It's an n-dimensional thing. And I want this following to be the situation. So let me have that throughout. And then my statement one is, let u be twice differentiable inside the domain. I think I only need it to be continuous up to the boundary. And I want it to be such that Laplacian u equals 0. But maybe subharmonic, Laplacian u is greater than or equal to 0. We'll get the same statement. If it's equal to 0, we'll get this statement for u and minus u. Okay? So it's subharmonic in omega. Then, if I take the max, x in the closure, the entire domain and in the closure, of the values of u, it's equal to the max of the values of u, but I only have to look over the boundary. That is, the maximum of the function is taken on the boundary. And if that's true, then you might say we have the easiest a priori estimate of solutions of the Laplace's equation. And I'll do that. Let me put that comment aside so I can carry on with the theorem. So if you're in that situation, so therefore, solve problem one, which was Laplacian u equals 0, u of x equals f of x, when x is in the boundary. Then if I have a solution, I automatically know the following bounds, that the minimum over x in the boundary of f of x is lies below, let's see, yeah, let me write it this way. Let y be in the domain. And I want to look, how big can u of y be? Well, it can't go less than the minimum of f of x on the boundary, and it can't go bigger than the maximum of x in the boundary of f of x. That's what the maximum principle says. Yep. Bounded, connected. Omega can't be compact because it's open. But its closure is compact because it's bounded. Well, it's happily u is in the continuous on the boundary. So I can have a singularity on the boundary, but I just excluded it. So you're worried about the min and max and the sup and inf, right? So if that means if it's true, if f goes to plus or minus infinity on the boundary, the your solution may not, but it may be unbounded. But if f is bounded as a bounded domain, f would be bounded. Then, yep, there you are. And this is what I said was the weak maximum principle, because it just says something simple. So I'd like to also talk about the strong maximum principle. And let me say it this way. Same situation. U is twice differentiable, because I want to use Laplace's equation, and continuous, including the boundary, as I was just being, as I was just debating. And it is subharmonic, so Laplacian u greater than or equal to zero. Then, either of two things holds. Thing one could be, for all x in my domain, well, let me say it this way. For all, I've been using y as the particular point in the domain. For all particular y in the domain, u of y is strictly less than the max over x in the boundary of u of x. Or else, two. Well, what happens if this doesn't happen? It can't exceed by the weak maximum principle, but it could be equal. The point is a strict less than. So if this doesn't hold, there's some point y in the domain. Only one point you need. One point in the domain where it equals the maximum over the boundary. If that holds, a very strong statement holds. And that says so. Or else, u of y equals the max over the boundary. U of x. For all y inside, that means u is a constant. And, in particular, u on the boundary equals constant. So the strong one is substantially stronger, you might say. All you need to rule out non-trivial solutions is to find one point in the interior where the maximum on the boundary is achieved. Then bang! That can't be any old function. It is a constant. And the constant is, of course, the maximum on the boundary, which is equal to the value on the boundary. You don't have any choice of other values. Very strong thing. Okay. Good. So let's move on. I guess, it's nice to divide it in two because the proofs, well, as in usual, as in most situations, the proofs are more interesting and more contentful than even than necessarily the statement of the theorems. So, let's prove. So, these actually have two different proofs, and let's give proof of case one. So let's do one first, and I'm going to do divide that into two cases. One case is when, remember, it's a subharmonic function. Laplacian u is greater than or equal to 0, but suppose it's always greater than 0. Could be. That's a subharmonic function. Well, then, suppose that this is true for all y in the domain. Okay? Well, then, let's examine a purported, y naught in the domain at which u of y naught is equal to the maximum u over the domain. Right? Let's suppose there's a point inside the domain where it works. Well, what can happen at a maximum? Well, here's what a maximum looks like. So in particular, the gradient of u at y naught has to vanish because it's the maximum, can't get higher. Right? And then the second derivatives, so in particular, what I want to say is a Hessian of second derivatives, the matrix of second derivatives, at a maximum point has to be negative definite. So the matrix dxi dxj of u, as a matrix I, j equals 1, to n as a matrix has to be negative definite. And in particular, that would mean that the trace of the matrix dxi dxj of u has to be a non-positive number. If you have a negative definite matrix, its trace better be non-positive. It can have entries which are positive, but not many of its entries are positive. But you know what this trace is? It's Laplacian of u. And so, at a maximum, Laplacian u has to be both less than or equal to 0 or greater than 0. Contradiction. Can't be. Okay? But that's only the case strict. And I didn't do what happens if it could be equal sometimes, bigger than other times. I mean, who knows? So let's rule that out as well. So now we'll do the general case. More generally, we asked about Laplacian u greater than or equal to 0. Well, so I can't address that with the same argument because less than or equal to doesn't contradict greater than or equal to. But I can do something, which is I can say I'm going to not inspect u, I'm going to inspect v. So define v of x was equal to u of x plus epsilon times something or other else. It's just a little auxiliary thing. And I'm going to make that epsilon times the square of the absolute value of x. Something convenient. Anything you want, but that will do. Okay? And now let's look at Laplacian of v, and that's equal to Laplacian of u, which is non-negative, plus epsilon Laplacian of x squared, which is 2n. So this equals 2n in particular. So this whole thing is 2 epsilon n, which is in particular bigger than 0. Right? And so now v has Laplacian greater than 0 because u is greater than or equal to 0, and that's strictly greater than 0. This is in particular strictly greater than 0. Okay? And that says something about v. That says, I need a bit of room here. I'm going to take this line down here. That says the following, that the max over the domain and its closure of v, which is u plus epsilon x squared, Well, let's see it this way. Let me say it this way. The max of V over the closure of the domain has to be less than or equal to the max over the boundary of V. Isn't that what we said? But the max of the boundary of V is, of course, equal to the max over the boundary of, well, what's the boundary of V? It's what's V on the boundary? It's the max of U plus 2 epsilon n. And what's the max over the domain of V? It's equal to the max over the domain itself of U plus 2 epsilon n. And I'll rewrite this as the max over U plus a constant, 2 epsilon n. And this is a max only over the boundary. You don't have to test the interior of U plus 2 epsilon n. And now just ray out the n. Ray out this. Actually, I take it back. No, I don't. That's perfect. That's just fine. That's just fine. Oh, something's wrong. I take it back. Help. I take it back. Everyone's objections. I thought it was a little too good to be true. U plus epsilon x squared. Thank you. U plus epsilon x squared. All those people who were puzzled had the right to be puzzled. Okay? And now I have to do the following thing. This one. It's because when I have a function which has strictly positive Laplacian, it satisfies the maximum principle. So V has a strictly positive Laplacian. So therefore, it satisfies the maximum principle by my case 1. So therefore, this is the maximum principle. Sorry? In fact, we have equality. Because, of course, the closure is equal to and contains that. So what it says is the maximum occurs on the boundary. In fact, there's equality. Okay? And now I have to do the last step again. That's where I screwed up. Which is, what's bigger than this? It's the max over U over the boundary plus the max over the boundary of epsilon x squared, so x squared, and I take the epsilon out. And now, let's do this side. What's underneath this? It's the max over the interior, or over the whole region of U, minus epsilon, max over the whole interior of x squared. That's where I screwed up. Oh, and this is that gets less than, and this gets possibly more than, right? And now it's a bounded domain. So the maximum of x squared over the domain is the maximum distance of the very furthest endpoint of the domain from 0, some number. And this is the same, some number. And I can take epsilon to 0. So taking epsilon to 0, taking epsilon to 0, we have the following. We have this plus epsilon times a finite number. Taking epsilon to 0, I get max over the domain, max over the full domain, the closure of the domain of U is less than or equal to, now I do the same thing on the right-hand side, max over, I only have to look over the boundary of U. Point. And as Slim points out, clearly, when I take the maximum over this includes that, so they're equal. What it says is the maximum is taken on the boundary. That's what it says. That happens for constants as well as for other things. Okay? Now we have a right for a tea break. More like a coffee break for me. But I want to do one more thing before that, which is going to take me some minutes. So that thing is proof of the strong maximum principle too, and that item two of that theorem, and that takes a different tack, and the theorem is also that method is also of interest. So I think we should run through it. So what I'm going to do is the following thing. Let M equal the soup over X in the domain of U of X. Okay, so U takes its U takes its values, it takes real values, and then U take the soup of all those possible real values as X goes over the domain. Okay? And then I want to decompose omega into two bits, omega 1 union omega 2, and it will be disjoint, where, let's see, which one do I want, where omega 1 is simply all those x in omega such that U of X achieves that soup. So it might be empty, but maybe not. So where it achieves that soup, and then omega 2 is all the x's where U of X doesn't achieve that soup. Okay? Can't have both. It's a disjoint union. And now let's do the following thing. Since U is in as a continuous function, even in the closure, this is an open condition. A continuous function less than a constant, so this is an open set. Omega 2 is open. What can I say? It's open as a set in the domain. It's an open set. Okay? What I claim, and I'm going to prove the claim on this piece of board here, what I claim is that omega 1 is also open. What can I conclude? How can you make a connected set be composed of two disjoint open pieces? You can't. Either one, or if both of them are not empty, you can't. So either one is empty or the other. So by topology, since omega is connected, it cannot be made out of two disjoint open sets, so therefore two non-empty disjoint sets, so either omega 1 is equal to omega, and omega 2 is empty. If omega 1 is equal to omega, that's the constant case. The solution is constant, point. No further work. Or else, omega 2 is the entire omega, and omega 1 is empty. That says, nowhere inside does U achieve the value which is the soup. That value which is the soup we know occurs on the boundary by the weak maximum principle, but it cannot occur anywhere on the interior without the other case kicking in. So I have to prove the claim. The proof of the claim depends on you proving problem set 5. So it depends on you, but let's have it given, okay? So that's, this is a, your problem set phi is a lemma which we're going to use for this proof. So let's do that. So let's take a, take X naught. So what we have to prove is that omega 1 is open. So let's take X naught in omega 1. And omega 1 is where U is a constant, is M. Okay? So if X naught is in omega 1, then what can we say? And I'm going to use that Laplacian U is greater than or equal to 0, and thus, remember, a problem set number 5, problem 2, and thus Gauss's law, Gauss's inequality, Gauss's law, arithmetic, you know, that for, what can I say? It's not even Gauss's law, it's the definition of subharmonic. Subharmonic. That's it. Thus, by problem set 5, subharmonic, and I have that integral equality, integral-related inequality upstairs. So that says the following thing. 0 is less than or equal to 1 upon omega n rho to the n minus 1. I mean, what am I doing? make a picture, first off. I have to prove that omega 1 is open. So X naught is in omega 1. What I have to show is nearby points to X naught also are in omega 1. That's what it means to be an open set. So I'll draw you a picture. Here's my domain. Here's my dividing line. Here's omega 2 and here's omega 1. And I have an X naught here. I have an X naught here. And now I'm going to use that integral inequality on little rows around X naught, little spheres radius rho around X naught. So that says the following thing. Integral over a sphere of U of X dS, this is the sphere radius rho about X naught, dSX, minus that thing has a left-hand side. I'm going to subtract it from the right-hand side, U of X naught. Okay? And I can rewrite this by saying, so I'm rewriting the right-hand side, 1 upon omega n rho to the n minus 1, integral over that sphere around X naught, of U of X minus U of X naught, dSX, just because this is an average over the sphere. So put in a constant, that is the value at the center, and its integral is 1 times that constant, which is what that line is. And furthermore, to annoy those taking careful notes, I'll use my eraser and say U of X naught is M, because X naught is in omega 1. Okay? And now I have to see the following thing. We have to take rho sufficiently small. In any case, I always had to take rho sufficiently small so that the sphere radius rho about X naught was in the domain. But in particular, all sufficiently small rho will do. So in particular, all small. So as soon as I find one rho naught which fits, anything smaller than that, all small rho will do. Right? By the picture. And now let's see the following thing. Suppose that this sphere went into omega 2. So suppose we're on the boundary. That means if we're on the boundary, how do I say this? Suppose omega 1 were not closed. How do I say it best? Help me out. Suppose omega 1 is supposed to be open. Suppose omega 1 were not open. Then we could find rows around X naught that were very small, such that this sphere went outside of omega 1. If it's open for sufficiently small rows, it stays in omega 1. But if it's not open, x naught is a point around which we can find points in omega 2 for all small rows. And since u is continuous, we can find bits of solid arc, solid angle, where it's. And so that says that u, x minus m, is negative on those pieces of solid angle. The most it can be is zero. But if m is bigger than u, this is going to be negative. So I'm going to put something here. I claim that if not open, there exists arbitrarily small rho such that strict inequality there. Right? So some of the sphere, we're integrating an integrand, u minus m, which is zero, but other non-substantial pieces of that sphere, it's negative. So you're testing every x naught. You're testing every x naught. If it's not open, there's some x naught where it fails. I'm now finding a contradiction of that failure. Okay? That's can't have such things. Let me try to say it. It's better to say it positive. I guess I said it in a negative way. Let's say it positively, which says around every point x naught in omega 1, there have to be, for all sufficiently small rho, u better be equal to m on the entire sphere around it. If not, we'll run into this contradiction. But that says all sufficiently small rows have all points in omega 1. That's an open set. So that's the end of our proof of the weak and then strong maximum principle. And maybe we can have a coffee. Yes? Suppose not. I know the physicist's proof. Suppose not. That's absurd. Let me say it again. For all small rho, u minus m has to be zero on the entire sphere. Let me negate that. Suppose omega 1 were not closed. Well, then there's some point in omega 1 were not open. Suppose omega 1 were not open. Then there's some point in omega 1 such that a sequence of rows going to 0 has the following property, that sphere intersects the other set. So u minus m is negative on a substantial arc of that sphere. On those rows, you get negative. But you're not allowed. You're not allowed to have any of those rows, any of those bad rows, around any of those bad points. Well, there's a graceful way to say that and a slightly less graceful way to say that. I somewhere interpolated between the two. That's, it's a coffee break time. And, it just strikes me that something this is not the time to talk about it, but just while we have it in our mind, one might consider an equation Laplacian u plus b of x dot rad u equals 0, which is not Laplace's equation at all. It has an extra vector field in here. But just to think about it for a sec, does the strong maximum principle hold? Oh, sorry, does the weak maximum principle hold? The b of x, which is some vector field, dot grad u. And what do you think? Think of our proof. At least the weak maximum principle hold for this? And what did we do? We looked at a point which was the maximum. And at that point, the first thing we discovered, at a maximum, the gradient of u has to vanish. And the Hessian of u has to have a particular sign. So at that point, this is irrelevant, and we study this. So the answer is yes, by the same argument. So you might think about the weak and the strong maximum principle for equations somewhat more general and see how those arguments work. I think our argument for the strong maximum principle probably doesn't go through because it depended very strongly, very, very much on the definition of subharmonic. But there might be another proof, so you can think about that. So now I want to talk about Green's functions. So let me say we were in the business of taking a fundamental solution, gamma x minus y, remember the Abelian notation, and add a function w of x. And I wanted w to be harmonic in x. That's what I needed to maintain a maximum function. It didn't really matter what it was. It could also depend on y. It didn't really matter what it did in y. But let's do this. And I'm going to ask, this is a fundamental solution. It's okay, so it's a fundamental solution. I need Laplacian with respect to x of w of x and y to equal 0. And I guess I need, I need w to have certain regularity. Like, it does not have the singularity. So I'll say w is in C2, and it has two counts, two variables. So I guess it's an omega cross omega. So it has two copies of the variables. X is in omega, and also y is in another copy of omega. It's special when I could do the following thing. When w of x and y, its dependence on y is chosen so that it's equal to minus gamma x minus y whenever x is in the boundary. And then let's see. Then what happens? Let's give it, in such a case, we're going to give this a name. I'll call it capital G. It's a function of x and y. And let's see what G satisfies. Well, distributionally speaking, the Laplacian G, that was what we had on the board right here last blackboard ago. It's Laplacian gamma plus Laplacian with respect to x of w. That was the one that was equal to the delta function because of the gamma, and 0 because of w's harmonic in x. And I can also say, to say it again, that means, that's a distributional statement, but it means that I can recover u of x by taking an integral over the domain of g, g of x, y, Laplacian u of y dy. No, I don't like that. I don't like that, so I'll take it away. But it means what we meant to be a distributional statement, that it has boundary data involved with this. So let me do that, actually. Let me make this a little bit more clear. So that line means the following thing, that I can find okay, let me say it the following way. That means I'm going to do the following thing. I'm going to take u of x equal to the integral over the domain of g of x, y, h of y, dy. I'm going to do that. And I want to see what happens to u. Well, let's see. So this means that this is what I want to say, that I take Laplacian with respect to x of u. That's a function with respect to x. It's integral over the domain of Laplacian with respect to x of g of x, y, h of y, dy. And we had a distributional way of saying that, which was that says it's h of x. That was our I haven't evaluated on the boundary yet. This is the Poisson problem. So this solves. So that is u of x solves the Poisson problem. We had this list of three or four problems. They all have names of 18th century mathematicians. This one is Laplacian u equals h, u of x equals 0 for x in the boundary. And this was our problem 3, actually. Problem 2, actually. Okay. And I want to see what happens on the boundary. Is that u of x, now I want to evaluate x in the boundary of the thing, it's equal to the integral of g of x, y, h of y, dy over the domain. But I want to evaluate this x in the boundary, and that's equal to, of course, integral over the domain of gamma of x minus y plus w of xy, h of y, dy. This evaluated at x in the boundary. And that's exactly what we organized to be equal to 0. So u, Laplacian u is equal to h, and u on the boundary is equal to 0. That's what I want to happen. Yeah, gamma.
So it represents a Greek function without boundary term?
Yeah.
So just a Greek function without boundary.
Yeah. So you're putting me in a tight spot, because when I see, that's what I erased here. My tight spot was what I erased here. We had a formula when it was gamma against Laplacian u, and we integrated by parts, and we found boundary terms. So I'm not doing that. I'm taking Laplacian directly on gamma. So what does that mean if there's a singularity? You take Laplacian on gamma, but a little hole around the singularity, and then you take a limit. And my answer is, and I'm sorry, I'm in a tight spot. I'm not going to do it. I won't assign a problem set. Is that this is what you get. Without a boundary term, that's what I want to say. This is what you get. So, G, if I find W to cancel the values of gamma on the boundary, then G is the Green's function. So G is called the Green's function. G of xy is called the... Well, there's a grammatical problem, and I had fights with editors over this. I think it is ungrammatically called the Green's function. Despite the fact it was Mr. Green who invented it. So the editor wanted it to be either the Green function, doesn't look green to me, it looks like white chalk, or Green's function without the, because it's his function. I can't help it. This is what people say, the Green's function. So there I'm stuck again, but grammatically this time. Incidentally, I won. Let's do an example. So let's do Rn plus, Green's function. The, just make sure I'm consistent. So what I want to do is, I have a half space. This is xn, and these are all the x prime variables in Rn minus 1. So I'm looking at up here. That's my domain. And I want to know, and I want to work at a point here, which is x, which is, of course, x prime xn. And so now I'm going to say I have to start with gamma of x, which is of x minus y. And that has the pole. And now I have to subtract from it something which is one harmonic in the upper half plane, upper half space, and two has the same boundary data whenever x is in the boundary. Okay? So let me do the following thing. I'm going to take x in the upper half space, and I'm going to just reflect to an x star here, which is x, same x prime, but minus xn. And I now run out of room. And I'm going to say that what I want, so and then I want to study this following function, x minus y minus, so my w is going to be minus gamma of x star minus y. And let's just look at its properties. And I think I got the right, that w, so w, which is equal to minus gamma of x star minus y, is harmonic in x star. Well, it's also in y, by the way. As long as x star stays in harmonic in x, also in y, as long as the pole, which is at x star, is not in the upper half plane. Y can be anywhere here. I'm worried I'm confusing X and Y. But in any case, that's true. X star is a function of X, and it's harmonic in X star. It's harmonic in X. And then let's do the other thing. If I set, if I take Y in, well, let's see. It's harmonic in X, also in Y, as long as X star, maybe this is not so important as the following. As long as y is in the upper half space. Because if y is up here, here's some other y. It's a function of two variables. If y is up here, it never gets close to the pole of that second function. So let's keep y in the upper half space, then it's harmonic in, then that funny other thing is harmonic in x. And let's also check the second property, which is I want to evaluate x on the boundary, of Rn plus. But if x is in the boundary, that means x is in the form x prime and xn is equal to 0. I want to look at x's of that form. And those x's have, for those x's, x is equal to x star. Right, because it's a reflection. It's in the axis, so its reflection is itself, and therefore, gamma of x minus y minus equals gamma of x star minus y. So their difference is equal to 0, which is which are the two properties that I want. And so, let's just put it to test. The Green's function for the upper half space, that is for R n plus, Green's function for the upper half space is equal to gamma of x minus y minus gamma of x star minus y. And let's write it down, because now we just derived it. 1 upon 2 minus n omega n, I'm putting in what's gamma, is 1 over x prime minus y prime squared plus xn minus yn squared. This to the n upon 2. N minus 2 upon 2 minus 1 over x prime minus y prime squared. Now I have to put in y star, x star, which is plus minus x n minus y n. I might as well get rid of the minuses and put a pluses because I'm squaring it to the n minus 2 upon 2. Close braces. Close braces. And this is for n greater than or equal to 3. So question for you, what is it for n equals 2? It's too easy to be a problem set problem. What is it for n is equal to 2? When n is equal to 2, okay, Green's function, x, y, is equal to, well, there's a 1 upon 2 pi, which is that thing, log of x, let's see, x1 minus y1 plus squared plus x2 minus y2 squared, 1 half. But then I have to subtract, let's see, the log. How about if I do this? I'm having trouble getting the power worked in, so it's 1 over 2 pi times 1 half, so 1 upon 4 pi times the log, and then I have to subtract the other log, so log of x1 minus y1 squared, that's the prime, and then I have to do the other one, plus x2 minus y plus y2 squared. Close. And the sum difference of logs is I can actually divide. X1 minus y1 squared plus x2 plus y2 squared. I can even get rid of that. And it's very possibly something you've seen in complex variables. Okay, I'd like to, so this is something that we derived, so that basically we derived this using the Fourier transform. Oh, actually, we didn't. But I want to move to something which we did. So let's move on to the Poisson kernel for Rn plus. So let's see. Actually, I want to move on. So this is a Green's function, meaning I said what a Green's function is in general, and I gave it to the upper half space. So let me say what a Poisson kernel is in general, and let me give it for the upper half space. Maybe that's the way should we go. So we're gonna this was the integral kernel with which we solved the Poisson problem, the Green's function. So what my theme here is that the Green's function is central to a lot of things. Okay. So let's see. The Poisson kernel is the following. So in general, it's the integral kernel. Used in solution of the Dirichlet problem. That was this problem one. And we already, We already derived that using the Fourier transform. Oh, sorry, for the upper half space, we already derived it using the Fourier transform. It was the first thing we did. So let's think about this one in general. So I want to do the following thing with regard to this. Let U be C2 in the domain. And I think I need boundary terms, so I better say it's once differentiable on the boundary, because I want to take some integrals on the boundary of its first derivative. And I want it to be harmonic in my domain omega. Well, then it satisfies the following thing. 0 is equal to integral of Laplacian u dx against the Green's function, x, y. And the Green's function has this w in it, also has the fundamental, this gamma in it. So I want to integrate by parts, and it gives me u of y. U of y plus a boundary integral. And I want to do that boundary integral. So this is a boundary integral of two things. G of x, y, partial, the normal derivative of u ds, I'm integrating in x, minus the boundary integral of the normal derivative of g of x, y, against u of x, the boundary in x. Isn't that right? And let me note that this is the integral over the boundary where x lies in the boundary. What is g designed for? To vanish on the boundary, to vanish when x is on the boundary. So this is 0. So that allows me to say, that's what I wanted to say, that is u of y. We take y inside the domain. U of y is equal to the integral over the boundary of the normal of u of x, the boundary data. I put this to the other side, it gives me a plus sign, times the normal derivative of the Green's function, x, y, d, s, x. And so that tells me that the normal derivative of the Green's function, evaluated at x on the boundary, is the Poisson kernel. So this is some what I want to call, don't want to give it a name. I'm just saying that this is an integral kernel. This is a function of x in the boundary and y in the domain. When you integrate against it, you can solve the Dirichlet problem. So it's the solution method for the Dirichlet problem. And now let's try it. Let's try this. Try this on Rn plus. Because it's always nice to do such things. So let's see if we can do that. So so that says on Rn plus u of y, so we're going to take y inside Rn plus, and then we'll have x on the boundary. It allows me to express u of y is equal to the integral over Rn minus 1 of this, I guess. Of the normal derivative of this. Right. So it's u of x, so it's going to be u of x. Oh, that's right. I want to make sure that's right. What we do in here is we put an f. So we say, how to solve the problem? We say, we're given f, data f, we integrate over the boundary, that data f, x, against some function, which is the normal derivative of the Green's function, x, y, v, s, x. Right? Now, let's do that in Rn plus. So I have data f of x, and now I have to take the normal derivative, which is minus the d by x n derivative. So because the normal, here is our picture of the domain. There's the domain, so the outward pointing unit normal is minus dxn. So we take the minus dxn derivative of the Green's function. Now we have this expression involving the Green's function, which was gamma of x minus y minus gamma of x star minus y. And then we iterate dx prime. And we have to evaluate. This is not this is times, right? Times that. And we have to evaluate. What do you think it is? So my claim is this is equal to exactly that thing, 1 upon 2 minus n, omega n. It's 1 over, 2 minus n, omega n, xn over x prime minus y prime squared plus yn squared to the n over 2, which we derived. I better check. That power. Suddenly had a nasty feeling about that power. I don't have it in this set of notes. Who has their notes? Check that power for me. This should be right. Which we derived using the Fourier transform when we said, here's my boundary data F, take its Fourier transform, extend, and it was your homework set. N over 2? Thanks. So it's the power N. So there we are. We are now come in a full circle. What we haven't done is the Neumann problem. Doesn't matter. It's yn integrate in x or xn integrate in y. It's the same thing. My notation is probably a little different from that than from this. Okay? So let's see. I had a problem set problem. I'm not sure if you want to accept it. Of check that this is that expression. Do you want that to be part of the problem set? The reminder is that I'm not here next week, so you might want to keep yourself amused by doing that. We vote in this class. Like in California, we vote in this class. All in favor of having another problem set problem, raise your hand. Boy, enthusiasts for work. One person, thanks. Two people. Okay, it's an extra problem set problem. Do it. Three. Do it if you want. So work this out. Please work this out. Work out. Please work out. And hand in. There we go. How about the Neumann problem? We've never addressed the Neumann problem. Which was, I want to solve Laplacian u equals 0, and then the normal derivative of u on the boundary equals some data, g of x, the Neumann data. So what I should do is take n of x, y, for general domains, so a general domain in Rn, this is not what I have in my notes, but this is what I want to do. I want to do the following thing. I want to write that for general domains, I want to do the following thing. I want to write n of xy. I also don't want to call it n for some reason, but I think I'm stuck. N of xy is equal to gamma of x minus y, but we're allowed to add a w of xy again. And I want with Laplacian with respect to x of w equals 0, and when I take the normal derivative of gamma of x minus y, these are derivatives with respect to x, right? I want that to be equal to minus the normal derivative with respect to x of w of x, y, whenever x is in the boundary. And if I find such an n, I will find that Laplacian n is equal to the delta function, and n satisfies, how do I say this? And if I define u of x equal to the integral of n of x, y, h of y dy over the domain, I will have the normal derivative of u of x equal to 0 on the when x is in the boundary, just as we did with g. I'm getting to the point where I suffer because I called it n, because that's not the problem at hand. What I've solved is the Poisson problem satisfying Neumann conditions rather than Dirichlet conditions, if I can find that w. I'm not guaranteeing I can find that w. But if I can find n, I can use n to solve Laplace's equation in the following way, that I now define u of x. Now, use n to solve, this was a problem 3, the Neumann problem. To solve 3, and that was the same way as that I just did with using the Green's function to solve the Dirichlet problem. That is, a harmonic function u satisfies u of y is equal to, let me just point. U of y equals to a normal derivative of g times u of x minus g times the normal derivative of u of x. So it's equal to minus, and this canceled because it's the normal derivative of n, which vanishes. So it's equal to minus the integral over the boundary of the n of x, y, normal derivative of u, ds, x. And that, for me, is equal to integral over the boundary of this thing, minus n of x, y. My data, g of x, ds, x. And so if we can find the Neumann-Green's function, we can solve the Neumann problem. Okay. My point in doing this was to talk about the upper half plane yet one more time. What happens in the upper half plane? So what I need is to add a w so that always the normal derivative vanishes. So I'm going to have n of x is equal to, well, I have, of course, gamma of x minus y. And in the Dirichlet problem, I subtracted gamma of x minus y star. Sorry, x star minus y. X minus y star is the same thing. Right? But here, I want the normal derivative to vanish, so I have to subtract x star minus y. Right? And this is the quantity, such that... I want it to be even with respect to... No, the maximum, it's a function with a pole. So maximum absolute value is minus infinity. But what I want is it to be even with respect to an interchange xn to minus xn rather than odd with respect to interchange. And so its derivative with respect to xn on the axis of symmetry has to vanish. And so that says that now this quantity is equal to 1 upon 2 minus n, omega n, times this plus this, so 1 upon x prime minus y prime squared plus xn minus yn squared, n upon 2, plus, well, let's put it down here, plus 1 upon x prime minus y prime squared plus xn plus yn squared, n upon 2. That's what I want it to be. Now, in doing this calculation, x sits in the boundary, and y sits in the inside. And so here, let's do the same thing. Let's put x on the boundary, y on the inside. But x on the boundary is xn equals 0. So that says when x is in the boundary of Rn plus, this is 1 upon 2 minus n, omega n. What do we have? We have twice this. 1 over x prime minus y prime squared plus yn squared n upon 2. I've got this wrong. N minus 2 over 2. N minus 2 over 2. And n minus 2 over 2. And this is also called the single layer potential. Single layer potential. It represents not a line of dipoles on the boundary, represents not a dipole on the boundary, but it represents a single charge on the boundary. Yes. Thanks. Absolutely. These were mods, and then they got curly. Only in two dimensions does it work out. And I'm running out of time. I wanted to do two more topics. What are you doing before 3 o'clock? No, I'm just joking. But I do want to do one more topic because it's going to take me a few lines. Okay? It's going to take me a few lines. And that is, I want to talk about the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. Who was in the lecture last Wednesday that just subsequent to the course given by Adrian Nachman? He talked about conformal maps, Dirichlet-Neumann operators, all these things that we had been looking at. This is the Dirichlet-Neumann operator once again. So what we have on a domain, I want to solve the Dirichlet problem. So I'm back to the Dirichlet problem. And that's in the following form. Oh, and I want to solve it. So my solution method now is that u at y is equal to the integral over the boundary if I have a Green's function. One of our theorems later on will be the Green's function exists. But I'm not proving that right now. Well, only for the upper half space. But if we do have the Green's function, then we have this expression for the Poisson kernel, which is the normal derivative of the Green's function, x, y, integrated to get f of x along the boundary. So remember, x moves in the boundary, and y is inside. And this is the Poisson kernel. I'm going to rewrite this, just to be clear, because there are going to be a bunch of derivatives flying around. So this is the normal, unit exterior normal at the point x. Here's the domain. Here's x. And I want it pointing out here. That's n. It's a function of x. N sub x. Dot the gradient with respect to x of g of xy. F of x dsx. Now I want to do the following thing. I want to take the gradient of my solution. Now I have to take y partial derivatives. And of course, what is that equal to? Boundary of the gradient with respect to y of this thing. Well, this depends on x, and so I can put those inside. N of x dot grad x, g of x, y, f of x, d, s, x. And now I want to actually give you the Dirichlet-Neumann operator expressed in terms of the Green's function. So what I want, so the Dirichlet-Neumann operator does the following thing. Given f of x, it gives me, in a row, it gives me u, a solution to the Dirichlet problem, which is harmonic. Then I take that u and I take the gradient, as I just did, right? And then after that, I take the limit on the boundary. Then I take n at the point y dot the gradient of u. This is all a function of y. This is now for y in the boundary. And that's an operator, which I should give a y's name to. I'm running out of letters. I'm going to call it k. K of f, and that's a function of y on the boundary. So in order to do that string of arrows, what do I do here? I take this gradient, I take its limit as y approaches the boundary, and then I dot that with the normal. But the normal at the point y, and of course that just appears here. So that's that interesting integral kernel. I just put parentheses around it. And that's the operator k, so it's an operator. So I'll make it a double line as I've been doing, k of f as a function of y. So just to recap the last half hour, I derived a Green's, I said what a Green's function needs to be. We have yet to prove a theorem that says it always exists for reasonable domains, but we said the Green's function needs to be, and we've derived it in certain cases, like the half plane, the half space. And then using the Green's function, I've expressed a number of things, including the solution to the Poisson problem itself using the Green's function, solution to the Dirichlet problem using the normal derivative of the Green's function on the boundary, its derivative in the other variable, which is the solution kernel which gives rise to the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. Notice down here, x has always been in the boundary, but here I evaluate, so y is also in the boundary. So it's a map from data on the boundary to data on the boundary. And then I did an analogous thing for the Neumann problem, to solve the Neumann problem. And I did it for the upper half plane. We had the single layer potential. We started the whole section studying the double layer potential. What I don't have time for is to show you the variational formula of Adamard. But I'm not sure I can work that in. Let me do it for the upper half space case. Okay? Let me do it for the upper half space because I think it's interesting. So I have f of x prime, a function on the boundary of the upper half space. Yes, it is well over the 2 hours, and so if you need to go, you can. But I have f of x data. Then what did I do? I said that my response, u of x, x is in the interior, Rn plus, was equal to, well, I had a bunch of expressions for this. The ones I had today, I'm actually not going to use now. I'm going to use the Fourier expression, which was, I took the Fourier transform of f. So I have f of y prime, dy prime, e to the I, c prime dot x prime minus y prime. And then I took e to the minus length of c prime xn dy, and then I had to integrate over all c primes. And this is over y prime in Rn minus 1 and also c prime in Rn minus 1. Remember that expression? And now what I want to do is I want to take the gradient of u. In fact, what I want to do is when I take the gradient of u and then I evaluate xn on the boundary, evaluate that on the boundary dot the normal, all I do is get the minus d by dxn derivative. So what I want to do is take the gradient. All I'm going to do is take the xn, the minus d by dxn derivative of u of x. And then I'm going to evaluate at xn equals 0, and that's the Dirichlet-Norman operator for the upper half plane. So that's k of f, and that's a function of x prime. You agree with me? And let's just do that with this integral expression. So it's equal to, well, there's a bunch of 2 pi's floating around, so it's 2 pi to the n, double integral. Now I have this exponential e to the I c prime dot x prime minus y prime, because those are all boundary integrals. I'm just copying this until it matters. I'm supposed to have taken minus the xn derivative. Where does that make a difference in this expression? Here. What's the xn derivative of this? C prime. What's minus the xn derivative of this? C prime. The xn derivative of this is minus c prime, minus it is c prime. So I have a c prime e to the minus c prime xn f of y prime dy prime dc prime. And now I'm supposed to evaluate it at xn equals 0. That just makes this 1. That says that this is equal to 1. So I'll rewrite it twice. One time I'm going to write it as following. 1 upon 2 pi to the n, double integral over r n minus 1 cross r n minus 1, e to the I c prime dot x prime minus y prime, they're all boundary values, boundary c prime, ouch, 1 f of y prime dy prime dc prime. Everyone agree? And there's one more, I want to write it one more time. It's because, remember, d by dxj is equal to 1 upon I d by dxj of a function f, when I hat it, is cj, f hat of c. So if you look at this, you see that this is doing the same thing with not multiplication by c, but multiplication by the mod of the vector c prime. So there's a way of writing this, which is saying, I can call this dj of f hat of c. Let me call this combination. D is equal to 1 upon I d by dx. Then this is modulus of d. So easy way to write this is modulus of d prime. It's a boundary variable. Modulus of d prime f as a function of x prime. I've just written it again. A neat way of writing that multiple integral. Neat notation for writing that multiple integral. That's the Dirichlet-Norman operator. Very interesting. For the upper half plane. Very interesting. Next time, we'll move on to, I'm sorry, I am missing the variational formula of Adamar. We have to do that in private. We'll have to do that in office hours, so to speak. Because I feel like it's interesting, but I also want to move along. So if you're curious about that, we can work it out. Thanks.